Right, good evening everyone. Welcome to Christians in Science. My name is Christina Biggs. I'm the Bristol Local Group Leader for Christians in Science. So tonight's talk is Alan Millard. Now, Professor Alan Millard was recommended to me when I was thinking that it would be really nice to have a talk, not about the sort of potted, you know, the Bible is true and this is why kind of talk that a vicar might give once a year, just to kind of reassure people. But actually, I was quite interested. I picked up a book once, and it was talking about debates. And I thought, oh, you know, maybe there's a story in there about how people solve problems. And I asked Ernest Lucas, who's here tonight, and he suggested his PhD supervisor, Professor Alan Millard, Professor Emeritus of Ancient Semitic and Hebrew Languages, which I think has got to be the best job title ever.
Good evening. Thank you for coming this evening. I'm very grateful to Christina for inviting me, for arranging this evening, for advertising it, and for kindly entertaining me at her home and bringing me here this evening, along with her daughter, to look after us both. It was quite an undertaking. Debates in Bible and archaeology. Somebody may say to you, I read that in an old book. Is it true? How do you know it right? And people often ask that sort of question about the past. And when that's the case, often the answer is straightforward. For example, the Norman conquest of England in 1066. We know from pictures on the Bayeux tapestry, we know from the change of names from Saxon to Norman of most of the landowners recorded in the Domesday Book, and on the silver pennies we see at the top King Harold and below King William, and really the only difference is the name. But in many cases, when we read about events in the past, such a range of information is not available to us. And if there's only one record, circumstantial evidence or archaeological discoveries may help. Some of you may be aware of the sagas that we have in Icelandic, telling of the adventures of the Vikings about 1,000 years ago. And one of them tells us of a man who sailed from Greenland to a place he called Vinland, because he found grapes growing there. And for many decades after these manuscripts from the 15th and 16th centuries were translated, scholars said, that's fiction. We can't possibly believe that anyone in a Viking ship would have sailed from Greenland to North America. And then in 1961, excavations in Newfoundland found the remains of a Viking settlement. Quite clearly Viking, with many Viking objects, typical Viking houses, showing that in fact the Vikings had reached North America. So those who had denied a factual basis to the Icelandic saga had to admit that there was some. When we turn to the Bible, oh, that's just to show you the way they went. They didn't leave the chart, it's been reconstructed. When we turn to the Bible, we're looking at two collections of books. One, the New Testament, you see here, is almost 2,000 years old. The other, much larger, the Old Testament or Hebrew Bible, is older still. Both contain narratives about events in the past, which the authors clearly set in historical time. Now, as you know, if you see two reports of the same event in different newspapers, you'll find that they're not identical. In addition, when we look at the Bible, we have to recognize that the books are religious books. They're not what we would call straight history. They're written by people with deep religious convictions, and in some cases, they're propaganda, trying to persuade others to accept the beliefs of the authors. If we call something propaganda, tends to carry a negative connotation. Think of political propaganda and all sorts of other propaganda, but propaganda can be good. I hope most of you would agree with me that the propaganda against smoking is good. Even if we believe the Bible is divinely inspired, we should still be prepared to examine its claims about ancient times, to discover whether or not what it narrates is in agreement with current knowledge about those ancient times. Please note that I say current knowledge, not current philosophy or current presuppositions. The ancient documents should not be made to fit modern theories, especially theories about the evolution of society or the evolution of religion. So we're looking at sources for factual information, not theological doctrine. Although there have been people who've used archaeology and written books saying archaeology proves the Bible is true, that is a mistake, because the Bible is basically a theological book, and no one can prove its claim that God spoke to Moses at Mount Sinai, or its claim that God was incarnate in Jesus of Nazareth. But we can look at other ancient records which tell of some of the same events as the biblical books. So we can have comparisons, we can have, if you like, controls. Do we find agreement? Or do we find discrepancies? Do they present the same story from different angles, or are they contradictory? From the days of the kings of Israel and Judah, we have quite a number of inscriptions from the kings of Assyria in northern Iraq, and they correspond well with what we find in the Hebrew books. For example, in the second book of Kings, Chapter 15, we're told how the king of Israel, Menachem, paid a heavy tribute to the king of Assyria, Tiglath-Pileser, whose picture you see on the screen. And in his monuments, Tiglath-Pileser records receipt of tribute from Menachem. So the two correspond. At a later time, we have a clay tablet in the British Museum, a Babylonian cuneiform tablet. It looks huge on the screen, but you could easily hold it in the palm of your hand. When the clay was soft, the scribe impressed the cuneiform signs with a stylus to record events in the reign of the Babylonian king, Nebuchadnezzar. And this chronicle notes the precise day when Nebuchadnezzar captured Jerusalem and took the young king Jehoiakim captive to Babylon, March the 16th, 597 BC. So this not only agrees with the biblical narrative that Jehoiakim was carried off to Babylon, but also gives us a precise date in biblical history. And from Nebuchadnezzar's palace in Babylon, we have more clay tablets, which list the rations issued to Jehoiakim where he was kept as a hostage in the Babylonian palace, along with some of his family. So here we see straightforward examples of how ancient inscriptions relate to, and in these cases agree, with the biblical narratives. From the 18th century onwards, many readers of the Bible have problems because of the episodes of divine intervention in human affairs, which we call miracles. And modern historians can't accept the occurrence of the supernatural. You cannot say God interfered in human history. So when we find occasions where biblical reports tell us that something or other happened because God caused it, modern historians say that can't be so and reinterpret them. Let us take one case. The famous king of Assyria, Sennacherib, boasted in his conscriptions how he campaigned against the kingdom of Judah and Jerusalem, the capital of Hezekiah. On the walls of his palace in Nineveh, modern Mosul, he left carvings describing or depicting his campaign. Happily, those carvings were brought to Britain in the 19th century, and you can see them in the British Museum. Had they been left in Nineveh, the jihadists would have destroyed them. during his campaign, Sennacherib was based at Lachish, the town you can see right at the bottom on the map. And his army captured the city, one of the most important cities in Hezekiah's kingdom, in 701 BC. Here you see the Assyrian general reporting to Sennacherib, who's sitting on his throne, that the town of Lachish has been captured. And at the other end of the picture, you see the leading men of Lachish begging mercy from the king. These scenes in the British Museum, if you are able to go and see them, are some of the very rare pictures of people from Judah in the time of the prophet Isaiah and King Hezekiah. But although Sennacherib left a detailed account of his campaign, which you see here on a clay prism, inscribed in cuneiform again, the original is about 30 inches high, Sennacherib doesn't claim to have conquered Jerusalem. He tells how Hezekiah paid him heavy tribute, but he does not claim to have captured Jerusalem. Since Hezekiah was a rebel against the Assyrians, we can be quite sure that if Hezekiah had fallen into the Assyrians' hands, Sennacherib would have told us with great glee how he captured Hezekiah, maybe dragged him along on a lead like a dog and took him as a prisoner to Nineveh. But he doesn't. And when we read the biblical account in the second book of Kings, chapters 18 and 19, we find that Hezekiah paid tribute to Sennacherib. And then we have a much longer narrative, which seems to be a filling out of the first account. And in this narrative, we learn how Sennacherib's officers came to Jerusalem, trying to persuade the people to give in, trying to persuade Hezekiah to surrender. But Hezekiah, encouraged by the prophet Isaiah, did not. And the Assyrians failed to capture Jerusalem because, in the words of the authorized version, it came to pass that night that the angel of the Lord went out and smote in the camp of the Assyrians 185,000. And when they arose in the morning, behold, they were all dead corpses. Slightly odd. So Sennacherib, king of Assyria, departed and returned and dwelt at Nineveh. As he was worshipping, his son smote him with the sword, and Esarhaddon, his son, reigned in his stead. Crucial questions arise. That final verse mentions the death of Sennacherib. We know that happened about 20 years after his attack on Judah. So the notice of his death could have been added to an existing record of the Assyrian attack. But a scholar has told us this account must have been written up after a considerable interval of time had elapsed and is intended to draw the maximum in the way of theological significance out of the fact that Jerusalem was not subjected to any military attack. In other words, we try to avoid the miracle. The miracle is characterized as a piece of narrative theology rather than an historical narrative proper. It's the point of view of people nearly 100 years after Hezekiah's time, we're told, who developed the idea that Jerusalem would never be captured, an idea which was quickly proved to be false. But all this is an attempt to avoid or explain away the miracle, because miracles don't happen. So modern interpretation has fought, been fought, modern presupposition has forced the interpretation. But if we treat this Hebrew narrative as we treat other ancient narratives, it is quite acceptable. A number of examples have been collected of Egyptian, Assyrian, Babylonian, Hittite kings recording events of their reigns, their campaigns, in which divine intervention plays a part. Here's an inscription from an Assyrian king of the 7th century BC, which tells how a king on the borders of Assyria had been paying tribute to Assyria and then entered into negotiation with a foreign king hostile to Assyria. And that meant he broke his oath of loyalty to the Assyrian king. Before the Assyrians could take any military action, the god of Assyria, Ashur, whom you see here flying above the king in his chariot, Ashur, the national god of Assyria, we're told, overcame this king from a distance and caused his body to burn with fire. The disloyal king, overwhelmed by fear of the Assyrian gods, sued for peace, sent tribute, and swore to be loyal again. But alarming as his experience had been, he soon returned to his former policy and in fact crossed the frontier of Assyria with his troops. Before the Assyrian army could advance, the gods intervened, and driven mad with a hideous disease, the enemy king died. And so the god of Assyria was glorified. The god had saved his reputation, protected his domain, and presented the king, his viceroy, with an easy triumph and assurance of divine favour. Now, in tone and expression, this is a factual narrative. Yet if it's judged as people judge the biblical account of Sennacherib and Hezekiah, it has to be labelled theological narrative writing. It may be less extensive, less complicated than the Hebrew record, but it is indubitably a proclamation of striking divine intervention in human affairs. What the miracle was that relieved Jerusalem when all those men were killed, we can't say, we can only speculate. If you think of the unhygienic conditions of crowded military camps in ancient times, an outbreak of dysentery seems very likely. But whatever the cause, for the people of Jerusalem, it was God's salvation. Just as the Assyrian king attributed the disasters which befell his enemy to the god of Assyria, so the people of Jerusalem attributed the disaster which befell their enemy to their god. So before discounting miracles in ancient reports, whether in Israel's history or the history of other nations, we should understand the way those people thought. When they couldn't readily explain an unexpected and beneficial event, they believed their gods had acted on their behalf. Even if the mechanics were clear, the timing of the event made it miraculous, as when the Israelites, fleeing from the Pharaoh's forces, reached the Red Sea, the apparently impassable waters parted because, the book of Exodus tells us, the Lord drove the sea back with a strong east wind. So we're not only told that God acted, but the mechanism of his action. And before we're tempted to treat these ancient records as the products of people who were superstitious, unscientific, or pre-scientific, we should take a moment to recollect what we find in a number of insurance policies today. The act of God for which the insurer will not insure you. The greatest king of ancient Israel, according to the Bible, was David. But outside the Hebrew Bible, there is no ancient record of a king called David ruling in Jerusalem. And that silence is enough to lead a number of scholars to extreme scepticism. So that one felt free to assert a few years ago, Bible stories about David and Solomon are not about history at all. David was a figure of fiction. One argument is that surely a king so powerful as the Bible portrays David should figure in the records of neighboring nations and should have left his own monuments. But that is not the case. But people who take that skeptical position need to take into account the circumstances of the time. If David did rule from Jerusalem, then that would have been about 1000 BC. The greatest extent of his rule, according to biblical texts, is what you see in a lighter colour on the map, right across Damascus and up to the Euphrates. And when you see the extent of David's kingdom and understand that some Zionists want to re-establish David's kingdom, you can realize why the Syrians in Damascus are not eager to be friends with Israel. If David did rule from Jerusalem, that would have been about 1000 BC. At that time, to the southwest, the kingdom of Egypt was in a poor way, with rival kings, and not interested in affairs beyond her northeastern frontier. In fact, from that period, we have hardly any records from Egypt at all, especially no records about diplomatic relationships. So the lack of any record of David in Egyptian sources is readily understood. To the northeast, Assyria and Babylonia off the map were also very weak, suffering under attacks from nomadic tribes who'd moved along the Euphrates and almost overrun the major cities of Nineveh and Babylon. So we have no records from those places that would be related to the kingdom of Israel. Closer to home, the Bible says the king of Tyre, which is on the coast just where the border of Israel ends. The kingdom of Tyre was in alliance with David. And so we might hope for archives from Tyre to tell us of that relationship. But Tyre was an island off the Lebanese coast. And people still live there, as you see from this aerial photograph. It was an island that was joined to the mainland when Alexander the Great had a causeway built to enable him to reach Tyre and capture it. And so this isthmus that is called Alexander's Causeway is there. But the original Tyre was the island at the right-hand side of the view. Tyre then was an island in the ocean. Very little excavation has been possible there because it's covered with modern houses. And although archaeologists are often very important people, they can't go around blowing up people's houses to see what's underneath. Because the soil is damp, any documents written on leather or papyrus, the ancient paper, will have rotted away long ago. We have a few inscriptions on stone, but they're later than the time of King David. There's nothing from David's time from Tyre. So the absence of any mention of King David from the writings of contemporary kingdoms doesn't imply that he didn't exist. Rather, we should examine the biblical reports in the light of ancient history. Evidently, the very weakness of the ancient great powers could make it possible for a king in Jerusalem to extend his rule over a larger area than any other who reigned there in later times. The neighboring kingdoms were not strong enough to prevent that. And for a strong kingdom to arise, as under David, and diminish as under Solomon, disappearing more or less within a generation or so, is not unusual. The cases of Alexander the Great and Napoleon immediately spring to mind. In 1993, an archaeologist was excavating at the site of the ancient town of Dan, which you can see in the brown splotch right at the top of the map, in the northern tip of Israel. During the afternoon, the rays of the sun struck a broken stone in a rough wall and lit up some marks in the stone. It was picked up and brushed clean, and lines of writing were observed to be on it, 13 lines of letters engraved on the smooth face. The stone is 32 centimetres high, and as you see, it's a piece broken from a larger slab. The first piece is the larger piece. Such finds are extremely unusual in Israel, so there was a feverish hunt for more pieces, and the two smaller pieces you see attached at the left were found. But most of it is missing. And yet, it is very significant. It's part of a victory monument written in Aramaic, the language of the Kingdom of Damascus, and in lettering which belongs late in the 9th century BC, say about 825 BC. The inscription seems to tell of a war between a king of Damascus, a king of Israel, and another king. The ends of two names are preserved. You see, I've restored the names, but the restored parts are in square brackets. So we have in the second line, Ram, which might be the end of King Jehoram, and in the third line, Yah, as in Isaiah, Jeremiah, and so on, which might be the name Ahaziah. We can't be certain about those identifications, but they're very likely. And in connection with the last one appears the word House of David, which is in the lower line that you see on the screen there. Just before it is one letter, which may be the end of the word for king, so it would be King of the House of David. The term House of David is a normal expression in ancient Semitic inscriptions for a royal dynasty, just as we have House of Windsor and so forth. Not to my surprise, all sorts of ingenious proposals were made to show that this inscription does not relate to the biblical David. Beth David, House of David, might be the name of a place like Bethlehem, House of Bread, or Bethel, House of God. But a straightforward evaluation based on the parallel expressions and the style of other victory monuments leads to the conclusion that this stone does name the dynasty founded by David, and so gives indirect confirmation that there had been a significant ruler named David sometime before the stone was set up, and the expression House of David in parallel with King of Israel supports that interpretation. One suggestion is that this expression Beth Dawith should be read Beth Doth, because in these ancient inscriptions the letter W can also serve as a long O. And the Hebrew word Doth means a cooking pot, so Beth Doth, House of the Cooking Pot, would mean a kitchen, in which case this monument was set up to commemorate the conquest of a kitchen. One of the most important men in biblical history is Moses. Is there any evidence for Moses outside the Bible? As with David, the answer is no. And so a lot of people say Moses didn't exist. They argue that the Bible gives us the only evidence, and the testimony of a single witness is not sufficient. Moreover, the Bible is religious propaganda, so you can't believe what it says. But I would argue that the one witness should not be dismissed so easily. Its testimony should be examined in the light of circumstantial evidence, for it may be true, and it's very unjust to prevent it being given a fair hearing. Last year, two books were published in which the writers argue, in the first one, for the reality of the Exodus record, the existence of Moses, and in the second one, for the non-existence of Moses and the fictitious nature of the Exodus record. Although no other ancient sources mention Moses, there is a lot of information available about the period when the Bible claims he lived. And that needs to be studied beside the biblical text to see whether they agree. Now, of course, it's possible for historical narratives to be accurate, but the characters in them to be imaginary, as in the best modern historical fiction. But it's very easy, even for the most pernickety modern historical novelist, to make a little mistake, to overlook something, to produce an anachronism that reveals the text was written long after the time described. Some years ago, I read a book about an adventure in the days of King Arthur. If King Arthur existed, he lived probably in the 5th century. And the hero of this story rode along on a horse and felt hungry. So he jumped off his horse, lit a fire, and baked a potato. Well, potatoes weren't brought to Britain until late in the 16th century. So this was an anachronism of 1,000 years or more. When we look at the accounts of Moses and his activities, the information in the book of Exodus and the other books of the Pentateuch, we find that they fit very well with the time we call the Late Bronze Age, between about 1550 and 1150 BC. Clear anachronisms of the potato sort are absent. Now, the Israelites had lived in Egypt for a long time, according to the Bible, in the land of Goshen, probably in the northeast of the country. And eventually they were forced to make bricks for the Pharaoh's building works in two places, Pithom and Ramesses. The place name Ramesses belongs in the 13th century BC. And on that ground and on other considerations, many believe that the time of Moses was in the 13th century BC, during the time of the great pharaoh Ramesses II, who ruled for 66 years. Her Majesty hasn't quite reached that. Regrettably, from the historian's point of view, the biblical writers didn't name the pharaoh. They simply spoke of Pharaoh. And that, in fact, was Egyptian custom at that time. When Egyptian documents were written which referred to the ruler, they simply said, the pharaoh. They didn't give his name and titles. As I've said, I think the 13th century BC was probably the time of Moses, but some scholars prefer an earlier date in the 15th century BC, largely because of this verse in the first book of Kings, chapter 6. The 480th year after the Israelites had come out of Egypt, in the 4th year of Solomon's reign, Solomon began to build the temple in Jerusalem. And since we can work out the chronology of Solomon, this would put the Exodus somewhere in the 15th century BC, 1446. For various reasons, that seems to me less likely than the later date. Pithom and Ramesses lay in the eastern part of the Nile Delta. Identifying them was for a long time a puzzle. But the site of Ramesses has been excavated. I hope you can read it marked there on the map, Khentia P. Ramesses. It was important for many centuries, but went out of existence about 1000 BC, when a lot of the stones from the monuments were moved to another place. The site of Pithom has also been excavated. Lower down on the map, underneath the word Wadi Tumilat, you will see two names, Tel Retebe and Tel El Maskhuta. Tel Retebe was long suspected to be the site of Pithom on the basis of a few inscriptions, and since 2007, excavations have proved that it was occupied under Ramesses II. But in the skeptical volume, second one on the list, the editor asserts that the town of Pithom was not occupied until after 1200 BC, too late for the Exodus, and therefore the record is incorrect. But he's not up to date with modern discoveries. Several factors are offered to support the contention that the Exodus text contains a distant and distorted memory of an actual event, or perhaps not even of an actual event. One of the reasons for skepticism, long adduced, is the number of Israelites. If you read carefully, you will find there were 600,000 plus Israelite men of military age in the Exodus. And if you add older ones and women and children, you have to reckon there are about 3 million Israelites in the Exodus. Another reason is the complete absence of any mention of Moses or the Israelites in Egyptian texts. And thirdly, it's asserted no event of the size and extent of the Exodus, all these people leaving Egypt, moving into the Sinai Desert, could have failed to leave significant archaeological remains in the Sinai Desert. For the large numbers, there are plausible interpretations which reduce them very considerably. And in a short while, you'll have a lecture from Professor Colin Humphreys, who has done an interesting work on this and shows statistically that it's likely the number was much smaller. A consideration of the situation in Egypt at the time of the Exodus may help us to understand why we're unlikely to find evidence of it. The Israelites lived, as I said, in the northeastern part of the country, where Ramesses was erecting the cities of Pithom and Ramesses. And this is the area of the Nile Delta, where the water level is very high. So any records the Egyptians kept of brickmaking, of Israelites doing this and that, written on papyrus or possibly on leather, will have rotted away long ago. The monuments of Ramesses and the other pharaohs all tell how powerful and devout they were. They boast of their victories. They never reveal a defeat or a disaster. So the absence of any reference to the sudden departure of a large labor force or of a series of catastrophic plagues is unremarkable and is certainly no reason for doubting the biblical record. We should not expect references from Egypt to those events. On the question of traces of Israel in Sinai, why don't we find any remains from the places where they camped 40 years in the wilderness? They were travelers with families, flocks and herds, living in tents, ready to move on whenever appropriate. Their craftsmen included metal workers and weavers and embroiderers, people to make incense, people to cook, to butcher animals. But there would not have been potters, because if you're in migratory society, you don't use pottery. It breaks too easily. You pack and unpack your goods. You need baskets and leather bags, not pottery. And pottery is what we usually expect to find as trace of ancient occupation. So to expect material traces of such people in the desert is to ask more than archaeology can produce. This is an illustration of a maxim which I enjoyed teaching to my students: absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. One Egyptian monument is very significant. The son and successor of Ramesses II, not his eldest son, was Merneptah, or Merenptah. He only had a short reign, but he made at least two military campaigns, a major one against Libya to the west and a minor one to Canaan in the northeast. And his scribes inscribed a triumphal poem about his victories on more than one stone stele, but this is the only one that's complete. It's known as the Israel stele because it proclaims that among those conquered in Canaan, Israel is laid waste without seed. Israel, in this inscription, is shown to be a group of people, not a place, not a land, not a town. So here about 1208 BC is clear mention of a group of people called Israel being in Canaan. That's far from saying Israel was a nation occupying the whole land. Indeed, other lines in the stele imply that she did not, but she was there, perhaps in the process of taking possession of the land. While Moses and Joshua remain leaders known only from the biblical books, there is no good reason to deny their existence, and the circumstantial evidence indicates that the narratives about them could stem from the times they describe. Ancient Israel's occupation of Canaan is another disputed subject. Through literary criticism, many scholars have concluded that the books of Joshua and Judges, which relate the story, were created in the 7th century BC or later, and present a largely imaginary history. Beside the literary approach, we should place the archaeological. Archaeologists expect, if they read of a new people entering and settling in a land, that they would have left their mark in new styles of the primary diagnostic product, pottery, in architecture, and in other material remains. But in ruined places of the 13th and 12th centuries BC in the Holy Land, the end of the Late Bronze Age, it's hard to see a difference in the pottery. The upper part of this slide shows pots which are assigned to the Late Bronze Age, the lower pots which are assigned to the Early Iron Age, and the differences are very small. The pottery, an archaeologist observed, turned out to be nearly identical to that of the Late Bronze Age. Based on the pottery evidence, we would not even suspect that there were newcomers at all. In other words, the pottery cannot show us that Israelites had come into the land. Moreover, in the hill country, in the centre part of the Holy Land, at this time, about 1200, 1100 BC, we find a large number of small villages in the hills, which were new. And some people take this to indicate a change in the populace. Putting the existence of those new settlements beside evidence from the major cities, it suggested that these new settlements were created by people who left the towns because the Egyptians who ruled the country were taxing them too heavily. And that would mean, if these settlements were settlements called Israelite, that the Israelites were latter-day Canaanites. and this is an idea which you will find quite widely today. In those settlements, there's a particular type of house. You see several examples here. A doorway, often leading into a courtyard, with a row of pillars on one side, a room on either side of the courtyard, and a room at the end. It's been termed the Israelite house, but there's no way we can prove these houses are specifically Israelite. But there is one major change between the end of the Late Bronze Age and the Iron Age. Over 20 shrines or temples have been excavated that date to the 13th and 12th centuries BC. Some were destroyed violently. None of them continued into the following centuries. The places where they had existed were not venerated in later times. Here you see an example from the city of Hatzor in the north of the Holy Land, and in the center is a stone pillar with hands upraised to the crescent of the moon. These are standing stones, like the stone that Jacob set up at Bethel, and later on stones that were set up at Gilgal and other places. These are not Stonehenge-sized stones, but stones which, with some effort, a single person could set up upright to mark a special place. So the change in religious observance seems to me to be a significant mark of a change in the population, and perhaps to be a sign of the arrival of Israel in the land. Archaeologists have supposed for a long time that when the Israelites conquered Canaan, they destroyed all the Canaanite towns. Well, the book of Joshua tells us that they destroyed Jericho, famously, and Ai. And the only other place that the book of Joshua tells us they destroyed was Hatzor in the north. But archaeologists have excavated at many places and looked for traces of burning, traces of destruction, which they could associate with the Israelites' conquest. But that's misguided. The book of Joshua tells us of many places which the Israelites conquered. They killed the kings, killed the people. But of course they wanted to live in the towns, so they didn't destroy them. They kept the towns. So their invasion would not necessarily leave visible traces. When William the Conqueror invaded England, he built new castles, replaced the Saxon landowners with Norman ones, struck silver pennies with his name on, which were very little different from those of King Harold. But the pottery didn't change. It took a long time before you see real change in early medieval English pottery. Invasions do not necessarily leave visible traces. Of course, there were no coins in the time of the Israelite conquest of the Holy Land. We could spend the whole night talking about other matters that are debated in the history of ancient Israel. There are some debated matters about archaeology and the New Testament, but of course the books of the New Testament cover a much shorter period of historical time, and the basic history of that age is well established. But archaeological discoveries can bring helpful additions. Pontius Pilate, the governor of Judea, was only known from references in the Gospels, in one or two other writings from the first century, until this battered stone was unearthed at Caesarea. It's a stone that originally had a longer inscription than you can see. It had been reused, reshaped for another building by somebody who wasn't interested in the inscription. But they didn't destroy the most significant part. In the second line, you can see the end of Tius and then Pilatus, Pontius Pilatus. And below, we can make out traces of his title, Praefectus Judaei, prefect of Judea. It's often been said that the gospel writers and the author of the book of Acts were not particular about their history. Pilate we often refer to as one of the procurators of Judea. But the term procurator wasn't introduced in the Roman hierarchy until about AD 40, so it's anachronistic to apply it to Pilate. He was the prefect, as this inscription says. When we look at the Gospels, we find that the Greek word used for Pilate is not the word that is a translation of procurator, which we find in the case of Felix and Festus in the book of Acts. So we can see that the Gospel writers reflect very accurately the Roman title of the Roman governor. Another interesting matter, for a long time, people have said Nazareth didn't exist in the first century. There are no references outside the Gospels to it earlier than the fourth century. But recently, remains of houses, such as you see here, and tombs, which clearly date to the first century, have been uncovered. So archaeology has ended that date. That debate. Studies of the four Gospels almost universally assume that they were written after the Romans captured Jerusalem in the year 70. Perhaps it suggested there were some earlier accounts, but most of the information would have been handed down by word of mouth, oral tradition. One authority wrote, "It is incontrovertible that in the earliest period there was only an oral record of the narrative and sayings of Jesus." So over the decades before the texts were written down, the words of Jesus could have been altered to take account of new situations which arose in the church and which needed a dominical ruling. Many books, many commentaries have been written on that assumption. But research on the uses of writing in first century Palestine has proved that writing was current in first century Jewish circles, not only among the priests and rabbis, but among a much wider range of society. Here is a document which survived in the very dry air of a cave near the Dead Sea, like the Dead Sea Scrolls, but it's not one of them. It's the document about the ownership of a cow, dated in the reign of the Emperor Nero. And at the bottom, you can see several shorter lines of writing. These are the names of the witnesses to the legal deed. And if you look at them, you'll see some are well written, some are more awkwardly written. The last but one is particularly awkwardly written. And the last line of all is neatly written by the scribe, because the witness couldn't write his own name. So the lines before are the names of the witnesses which they wrote themselves. And these were ordinary people just witnessing a legal deed. And in the Gospels, it's assumed that many people could read and write. There's a real possibility that some of the disciples or their friends could have written down the words they heard Jesus say. They had little tablets made of bone like this, which you can hold in your hand. The inner faces covered with wax, had larger ones as you see on the left-hand edge of this slide. Here are a group of tax collectors, and that pile of tablets is the record of the taxes that people had paid. And you remember one of the disciples was Matthew Levi, who'd been a tax collector. So the likelihood of people writing what they heard and saw is quite strong. We shouldn't suppose that the Gospels only rest on generations of oral tradition. Another debate that existed concerned the existence of synagogues. No synagogues existed in Palestine before AD 70. There may have been places where people met, but they were not formal synagogues. So references in the Gospels and other texts to synagogues were interpreted in that way. Meeting places, but not necessarily religious synagogues. Now excavations have unearthed at least half a dozen synagogues destroyed by the Romans during the first Jewish revolt between AD 66 and 70. The one you see in this picture is a small one found quite recently at the town of Magdala in Galilee, the place where Mary Magdalene came from. And in the near the centre, below that black and white measuring stick, is a stone block which is carved with the seven-branch candlestick, the menorah. That was significant in Jewish worship. Interpreting ancient books needs honesty, of course, knowledge of their languages, and especially of the times they describe. Interpreting archaeological discoveries needs understanding of why some things survive and others do not. Needs recognition that what may be found may be only a small proportion of what did exist, and it's very rare that an ancient site is completely excavated. And even places that have been extensively excavated have produced dozens of pieces of pottery which are not complete. Half a jug. Where's the other half? Not found. So we have to recognise the fragmentary nature of the information we receive. When the Bible is read in the light of knowledge of its world, it's frequently harmonious with it. There are many questions that still demand answers. There are some disagreements that remain to be solved. But that is true with many ancient books, not only with the Bible. And so many questions and disagreements have found satisfactory answers in the past that we can be optimistic about others. Wherever sufficient evidence is available, the Bible proves to be an accurate record of the events it describes. I've been studying the world of the Bible for over 60 years, and I've yet to be shown a place where there is a clear, indisputable contradiction between a biblical text and some ancient witness. Wherever sufficient evidence is available, the Bible proves to be an accurate record of the events it describes. Thank you.
I noticed you started us off with Moses and at the beginning of your Old Testament dating. I just wondered if you had come across a video called Patterns of Evidence with David Roll and our own John Bimpson from Trinity, pointing to the fact that Ramses looks like the name is an anachronism, and actually a new city has been discovered underneath Ramses called Avaris, which has lots of fascinating stuff in there, which might point to Joseph onwards. And I wondered if you had a comment to make about that video.
Yes, I know John Bimpson's work. I simply find it unconvincing. It's quite possible that the town called Ramses had another name and was then called Ramses at a later time, and the biblical writer used the later name. But when the Israelites were there, it wasn't called by that name. But I don't find that argument fits with other sources of information about the 13th century BC in Egypt and in Canaan, which seem to me to point to the 13th century date for the Exodus very clearly. I think some of the ideas that John Bimpson has taken up rest on the work of a gentleman called David Roll, who was one of those people who said, it must be there, so I'll find it. And so he found it. There have been one or two other people who've been even more adventurous. One man claimed to have found Noah's Ark, and then under the area of the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, he found the Ark of the Covenant, and he took a photograph of it. But when he developed the film, the aura of the Ark had been so great that the film was completely black. And this was, again, wishful thinking. We have to be very careful. As I said, some people prefer the earlier date for the Exodus. I don't find that convincing. If you want to find an extensive and very well-documented presentation of the case, then you should look at the book by my good friend, colleague, Professor Kenneth Kitchen, called On the Reliability of the Old Testament. On the Reliability of the Old Testament.
Which I've got a copy of, but it's very dense. It is, Brendan? Oh, yes.
You said that there could be written traditions before the Gospels about sayings of Jesus. Yeah. Mark Chancy and Catherine Hetzer, who have written extensively on this, have argued how there is not that much evidence to writing, especially in Greek, during that time. Could you not put a spin on it compared to what you said, that it could be that although there's some writing, mainly from more upper class, that the lower class wouldn't able to write, and therefore that's why there could be just merely oral traditions?
Thank you. Who could write in first century Palestine before AD 70? My case is that many more people could read and write than has often been thought to be the case. Remember in the Gospels, Jesus told the parable of the unjust steward, and he wanted to curry favor with his master. So he told one of the debtors, take your note of debt, cross out 100 and write 50, assuming that this man who owed some money could do that. Obviously, the scribes and Pharisees, the priests, were people who read. But today, every Jewish boy at Bar Mitzvah at 13 is expected to read a passage from the law in the synagogue. And according to the Jewish historian Josephus, writing at the end of the first century, that was the case then. Well, I'm sure a lot of the boys learned a passage by heart and didn't actually read it. But that picture I showed you of a legal deed with the names of witnesses written by each one at the end, in this case written in Hebrew, is an indicator of people being able to write. They weren't people who were using writing every day, but they were able to write their names and probably to read more. Reading and writing don't necessarily go hand in hand. If you look at the coins which were used in first century Palestine, you find that the coins of Herod have inscriptions only in Greek. The coins that the procurators, Pontius Pilate and others, issued have inscriptions only in Greek. When the Jewish revolt was established, the coins issued by the rebels have inscriptions in ancient Hebrew. Other indications, such as this document and other documents found with it, show that Greek, Aramaic, and Hebrew were all being used in daily life. Have to remember that first century Palestine was a cosmopolitan country. Some people have said Galilee was a backwater, but in fact, Galilee was on the main road to Tyre, to the northwest, and to Damascus, to the northeast. In the Gospel period, Herod Antipas was building a new city, Tiberias, on the shore of Galilee. And that would have involved a lot of people with paper giving orders receiving orders, issuing accounts, and so forth. In the Gospel of Luke, we read how on one Sabbath day, Jesus went into the synagogue, was handed the scroll of the prophet Isaiah, and read from it and expounded it. And again, from Josephus, we understand that every synagogue would have had copies of the Old Testament scriptures, if not all of them, certainly, of the books of the law, so that people would be able to read them. I wrote a book called Reading and Writing in the Time of Jesus, in which I tried to gather this information together, and if you're really interested, that's where you should look.
Sorry, could you just say that again more clearly, please?
So I have read it. I quoted you in my thesis. That's why I wanted to ask you the question.
Okay, next. Brian at the front.
You mentioned a book by Colin Humphreys, and I've just recently read that book with great interest. And I think it was written maybe 20 years ago or so. I'm just wondering, are there any comments on the book? I tried to find something on the website, but did people write comments on that book? And then secondly, he was very interested in moving the site of the sign at Mount Sinai to the other side of the Gulf of Aqaba, on the east side, and he thought it could have been very likely to be a volcano mountain. Have you got any comments on that?
Professor Sir Colin Humphreys, who will lecture to you fairly soon, wrote a book about the Exodus in which he argued that Mount Sinai is east of the Gulf of Aqaba in modern Arabia. I'm quite sure he's wrong. You may find, if you look at his book, that he acknowledges my help in the introduction to the book, but says he knows I don't agree. And he has now withdrawn his opinion. Very satisfactory.
That's an interesting thing.
First of all, the journey that's involved is much more difficult than the journey round the Sinai Peninsula that the Book of Numbers gives as an itinerary. They would have had to cross the northern central part of the Sinai Desert, which doesn't have the wells and so on that they would need. But the real reason why people look for Mount Sinai in Arabia is a passage in the letter of Paul to the church in Galatia, in which he uses Abraham's slave wife Hagar as a figure and says Hagar is Mount Sinai, which is in Arabia. Arabia to us is Saudi Arabia, but Arabia in the first century included the Sinai. So I think this idea largely rests on a misunderstanding. Professor Humphreys isn't the only person to have this idea. A number of people have had it and have explored, when they've been allowed to, in Western Arabia and claim to have found 12 stones which Moses had erected at the foot of Mount Sinai and so on. But it doesn't seem to me that this is really evidence of the Israelite presence there. One particular explorer who claimed to find all the things that you would expect to find at Mount Sinai, except the one thing that I'd like to find, which are the fragments of the tablets Moses broke. But the Saudis confiscated his photographs, so we can't see them. And he was one of these people who found what he expected to find. So I don't accept the idea that Mount Sinai lay east of the Gulf of Aqaba in Saudi Arabia.
Thank you very much indeed, Professor, for that extremely cogent presentation. You mentioned Hatzor and the sort of evidence there that does suggest some backing for the occupation by the Israelites of the Promised Land, the Holy Land. What view do you take on something that's often cited as counter-evidence, which is Catherine Kenyon's dating of the destruction levels at Jericho, which seem at first sight to look like, very much like the biblical account, but she dated them at a date which was far too early for any possible occupation date. Do you take a view on that question?
Thank you. First of all, Hatzor, yes, evidence has been found of very extensive destruction at the end of the Late Bronze Age, but there's no notice saying, I, Joshua, destroyed this town, and so we can't be certain. The present excavator, Amnon Ben-Tor, and his predecessor, Yigal Yadin, were both convinced this was the work of the Israelites, and it could well be so. But I will not say yes, because we can't be certain. It could be so. I mentioned at the end of my lecture that there are many other debatable matters, and the question of Jericho is one of those. I'll try to compress a whole lecture into a few minutes. When the Israelites crossed the Jordan, you know the story, they marched around the walls of the city of Jericho for 6 days in silence. On the seventh day, they marched around 6 times. On the seventh time, they shouted and blew their trumpets. The walls fell down, and they went in and conquered the place. There was an archaeologist at the University of Liverpool in the 1930s who excavated at Jericho, largely funded by a gentleman who wanted him to prove the biblical record is true. And he came back to Liverpool after one season and said he'd found the walls that fell to Joshua's men. He was telling his colleagues this at lunchtime. Ah, said the professor of music, they blew trumpets, didn't they? Yes, said the archaeologist. What note did they blow? Can't possibly tell you that. I can, B flat. In the 1950s, the British archaeologist named Kathleen Kenyon went back to Jericho because a number of people had been very uncertain about the results of those earlier excavations. The way the pottery was dated and the stratigraphy, the layers of soil related to the walls, didn't seem to agree with the date in the 15th century BC, the higher date of the Exodus, which is what the first excavator claimed. And with the benefit of more research and excavation at other sites, Kathleen Kenyon excavated and was able to show that in fact those walls had fallen, but they'd fallen about 1,000 years before Joshua and the Israelites could have been there, on whatever date you give to the Exodus. Her excavations failed to find very much of Jericho from the 13th century BC. They did find evidence of occupation in the 15th and 14th centuries, but no sign of a major destruction. Jericho was left unoccupied for some time. The walls were made of bricks, which were simply mud, dried in the sun. Jericho stands in the Jordan Valley beside a very strong spring, that's why it's there. And you can understand that if the city was abandoned, the fierce wind that blows off the Judean desert into the valley would have a strong erosive effect on the mud brick walls. And M. Kathleen's work found at one point on the highest point of the mound, the footings of the wall that had encircled the town in the 16th, 17th century BC. Any later wall, or the upper part of that wall, had been completely eroded. And it may well be that there was a small occupation in the 13th century BC, which was eroded in the same fashion. A very small amount of pottery that could belong to that period has been found, but no sign of either destruction or occupation at that time. So this is one of the continuing debates. More excavations have been made recently by an Italian expedition, but they've not found anything later than about 1500 BC. So Jericho is still a question.
Thank you.
I think I'm just intrigued by the concept that, if you like, I studied geology as one of my options at university, and I think there is there the notion that you only see what has not been eroded, and there's a certain amount of destruction. But I suppose with geology, you know, what gets washed down the mountain will find its way somewhere else. So I'm just sort of intrigued by kind of what percentage is actually left from... Is there any feeling for how much is actually destroyed and what you'd expect to find from, say, 100, I don't know, examples or something?
What you find is quite unpredictable, and it varies very much from place to place. I know nothing about the archaeology of Bristol, but I think there was a Roman town here, wasn't there? Yes? Bath, certainly, yes. And if you look for the Roman remains, you have to dig through the remains of Georgian and medieval Bath to get to the Roman remains. And they may be 15, 20 feet below the modern road surface. In the Near East, where the building material was mud brick, which decays much more rapidly, you find a bigger deposit of remains, sometimes just masses of fallen mud brick, and underneath a floor. But you don't find anything interesting till you get down to the floor. Other times, there's been great erosion, and you find most of a building has disappeared. Perhaps it's been a mound of ruins, and rainwater has eaten into the ruins and washed away some of it. There are all sorts of different possibilities. And people have been excavating Jerusalem for getting on for 150 years. And people don't think they've found, or I don't think they've found, anything that clearly comes from the time of King David. Why not? Well, people still live there. And people in later times weren't interested in those old buildings except as sources of stone. So they pulled up the stones and reused them. When the Romans rebuilt Jerusalem, they cleared away a lot of the old buildings to quarry into the rock for new building material. If you walk round the old city of Jerusalem, round the walls built by the Turks in the 16th century, I think at two places you can see a Roman inscription upside down. They were simply reusing the stone. And this happens again and again, and we still do it. Recycling is nothing new.
Thank you for coming to speak to us tonight. And I think you've already touched on it in some of your answers already. But I was going to ask, could you share some of your thoughts or comments on the usefulness and the limitations of carbon dating and other similar methods of contextualising the dates of artefacts outside of geographical or rulers and such contexts?
Yes. Dating archaeological remains is a complex subject. Obviously, after 600 BC, when people began to make and use coins, they can be very valuable dating evidence. If you were to dig up this floor and find a coin of King George V underneath it, you would know the floor had been laid after that coin was made. Whether immediately after or many years after, you couldn't say. But if, I trust it won't happen, the roof fell down tonight and there was a coin of Elizabeth II on the floor, that would help people to know that the roof had fallen down, at least after that coin had been made. So coins can be especially helpful. Inscriptions, of course, operate in the same way. Ancient pottery, we put in sequences and find different levels with different styles of pottery. If you go and look in an old china cupboard, your grandmother's perhaps in your case, you'll see teacups of different shapes. And you know some are the ones you could buy recently, others are cups that she was given when she was married many years ago. There are fashions in teacups, there were fashions in ancient pottery, which enable us to draw up a sequence. But since 1947, I think, a means of dating has been worked out by physicists and chemists, which is called the carbon-14 system. All of us, while we're alive, absorb an element called carbon-14 into our bodies. But as soon as we die, we stop absorbing it. So this piece of wood absorbed it while the tree was alive. But as soon as the tree was cut down, it stopped absorbing it and it began to decay. But other elements that were absorbed at the same time don't decay. And scientists can tell you the rate of decay of what's called carbon-14. It can be measured against the others. And it has a fixed period by which it decays by half. And then again, until it's all gone. This works back to about 10,000 BC, I think. There's someone else here who could probably tell you more about it. And people have thought it was very precise. Then another method was discovered, really one that is obvious, which is using tree rings. In the edge of this piece of wood, you can see the rings. You know, if you cut down a tree or cut off a branch, you see concentric rings. Each year, another ring appears. And so if you look at them, you'll see some are thick and some are thin and some are in between. And that depends on the climate. So by getting lots of pieces of wood and overlapping them, it's possible to build up a sequence over a very long period. And this was done partly using medieval paintings, some of which are dated on wood, and comparing them. And then in California, there is a tree called the bristlecone pine tree, which grows to a considerable age. And again, the rings can be compared. But with carbon-14, so with tree ring dating, it's been discovered that there have been all sorts of disturbances, which means that you can't be certain. So if a carbon-14 date of something is given, say, 940 to 700 BC, say 240-year range, the date can be anywhere within that range. If you have a lot of dates, you may find they overlap in such a way that you can narrow the date down. But quite often you can't do that. So we have to recognize that these systems are not quite so precise as science might make us suppose.
Thank you very much. I think we'll finish the formal questions there. Obviously come up and chat to Professor Millard if you want to stay. Professor Millard knows everything. You know, we were throwing all these questions at him and it not only had an opinion, we could back it up and got the science. It's just such a privilege to have you here. And, you know, I really do hope we'll continue the relationship. And thank you so much for coming down.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure. Thank you.